Welcome to The Scrap Show, a production of Recycling Today. Covering the business of scrap metal recycling, we feature conversations about markets, technology, the industry's rich history, and the traditions and ways of doing business that stay reliably familiar. Listen in as guests from across the country and around the world, processors, traders, and industry allies, provide insights and observations. The Scrap Show. A conversation between friends in an industry with a rich history and a bright future.
Hello, everyone. I'm Brian Taylor, Senior Editor with the Recycling Today Media Group, and welcome to The Scrap Show. We're here to talk about scrap recycling, and in each episode, we find out a little more about our guests' journey through the scrap industry. Today, it's my pleasure to be speaking with Murat Beyram, a non-ferrous metals trader working from Hamburg, Germany for EMR Limited. That's a UK-based metals recycling firm that I suspect most of you are familiar with. Murat also served as board member of the Berlin-based Association of German Metal Traders and Recyclers, known by the acronym VDM. And he also has been a very active member of the non-ferrous division of the BIR, the Brussels-based Bureau of International Recycling. And in those roles, he has been a voice for the free and fair trade of recycled metals. And we'll certainly talk about that as part of our conversation, I suspect. Murat, welcome to The Scrap Show.
Yeah, good morning to Singapore. Good morning, Brian.
Thank you, sir. As I typically do on this podcast, I'd just like to find out how you got your start in this sector. When and how did you get your start? And are you part of a family with a scrap background? Or did you find the industry through some other means?
Yeah. Do you know the word kismet, Brian?
Kismet. I'm vaguely familiar with it. It's a fate, I guess. It's sort of tied to fate, I think.
Yeah, in Turkish language, this stands for destiny. So I am a firm believer of destiny. I mean, in the idea that there is a grand design guiding us along our journey. So believing in destiny isn't about passively waiting for things to happen. It's about actively engaging with the world around us, so trusting in the unseen forces that guide us, and having the courage actually to walk through the doors that the destiny opens. So now, why I'm telling you this and coming back to your question, Brian?
Certainly.
No, I don't have any background with recycling in my family. So in my hometown, Hamburg, we're talking about the 90s. My journey actually into the world of recycling business began unexpectedly. I was winning a scholarship and I was actually embarking on a dual study program. And that was my initial plan. And I was armed with a check of 10,000 Deutschmarks. You know, that was a lot of money in the school times in the 90s.
For the purchase
of computer and other technological wonders and to realize my study. However, life had a completely different script for me, or let's say kismet. That's why I ask you, do you know the word kismet? So just 10 days before stepping into the realm of finance and insurance, another door opens. And you asked, so I'm going a little bit deeper on it. One evening, I think I was 19 years old amidst friends, I found myself mediating in a tense situation, diffusing tensions among a group of men with, let's say, too many drinks before, I guess. So little did I know that this diplomatic intervention would introduce me to my first mentor in the metal industry. So the person whom I helped from a quite tricky situation was from the recycling industry, and he did invite me to his yard. So I followed his invitation, and I stood on completely unfamiliar ground. I mean, I was surrounded by colossal excavators, you know, towering over vast steel heaps,
right,
where goods were heaped from one area to the another. And I didn't have any clue what I'm doing there. So clueless about my role, my inner compass whispered that I was in the right place, even if the specifics eluded me. So as I abandoned the path to a potential career in insurance, I embraced the world of recycling. So back then, you might confirm this, Brian, from a perspective of a journalist, the Green Deal was a distant concept, right? And in the 90s, and discussions about the importance of carbon savings were not really relevant in the 90s media and newspapers. So, so in a time when sectors like banking, consulting, and insurance were the state-of-the-art working places with high prestige, my decision was met with skepticism from friends who believed I'm making a big mistake leaving the study program in the insurance world and going to the recycling sector. And wow, today, nearly three decades later, Brian, I found solace in returning the same sentiment to my friends, sharing Lotta over how times have changed and how underestimated this industry was. So no, there is no family background, and there was kismet, let's say that way.
Okay.
Destiny was bring me.
Yeah. Please continue.
No, no, I just say, I mean, like the destiny which opened that door, let's say.
Yeah.
Yeah. I still say it was, is, and will be the best industry in the world. And it makes fun to work in this industry.
Certainly. Yeah, I agree 100%. What have responsibilities you had since then? What sort of tasks, jobs, trading, processing? You know, what has been keeping you busy these last 25 to 30 years?
Yeah, there were a lot of things happened, of course, in the last three decades. I have held various responsibilities and conducted business in numerous cities and countries, actually. And so I completed all my studies in the weekends and in the evenings. So I made this apprenticeship at the place what I just mentioned, where I didn't have a clue in the first moment what I'm doing there, but where my inner compass said, yeah, that's it. So I completed the studies. I finally did my MBA in finance, and I embarked on a journey that led me to establish international business firm operations from a prominent group in Germany. And then as I grew up in two worlds culturally, I mean, in the 70s and 80s, it was Turkish and German world. Yeah. So I did learn very fast to build bridges between cultures, Brian. Okay. For having a better understanding. You know, so my grandparents came from Turkey to Germany, and I was living actually in two worlds. There was a world with my family, and then there was a world in the school, of course. And that experience helped me a lot while I was traveling in the world. I think, honestly, speaking a language is not the guarantee to understand people. I mean, sometimes you can also communicate and build relationships only by being there and showing your willingness to cooperate. And then I became a partner in a medium-sized recycling company that's already 15 years or so going to even more. Today I'm working at a wonderful place, EMR, where I oversee the European metal business, as you introduced already in the beginning. The funny thing is, I find myself back in an office where my journey began nearly 30 years ago, because my current company, EMR, had taken over the locations from my first apprenticeship. So,
speaking of circular,
it's a little bit like you might know Paulo Coelho and the tale The Alchemist, where someone embarks on a journey into the wide world to discover their destiny, only to end up back where they started. So it sounds surreal, but it feels very right. So over the course, let's say that way, of nearly three decades, my journey began in Hamburg, as I said, extending to the Netherlands, whole Europe, Asia, the USA, across African continent. Yeah, and now I find myself back in Hamburg, actually. So my city of birth, yeah.
Indeed. Okay. You had mentioned that you had not always been stationed in Hamburg, and it sounds like Hamburg, and it sounds like you've mentioned several places where you conducted business. Any favorites or any you'd care to think of as highlights while you were out there?
I would say, my favorite is my hometown because I don't know. I mean, I stroll the streets here with my children today, and remembering my childhood where I once walked as a young boy delivering newspapers. So, this is the best connection. But having said that, every country, every area, and you might confirm this as well, Brian, because you traveled a lot as well, and has its beautiful areas, moments, and every culture has its beautiful you know sides. So I think if you are ready to enjoy, and if you are ready to if you're open enough, let's say that way, to let in the different cultures and the different moments, I think every place can be beautiful. You know, I found out if you go a little bit closed into areas and you are not really willed to be open, every place, even the most modern luxury place, can be horrible. So it's all a little bit about you and how you enter the areas, or how you, let's say that way, go this journey. Yeah.
Okay. Well said. It's very well said. Thanks for the insight. Through all this, and partly because of the way you've gone about it, you've become involved, it seems like, an international or global aspects of non-ferrous trading and a couple of different associations. How did that all start? When did you first sort of dip your toe into the waters of association governance, I'll say, or involvement?
Yeah.
And how did that go from the point where you started to where you are now?
Yeah, actually, it all started in ferrous. It didn't start with non-ferrous because, so, you know, my first mentor thought it's a very good idea to be, let's say, or to start in the ferrous business, because by that time, and still, Turkey is a very important steel importer, of course, recycled steel importer. So I found myself quickly diving into the ferrous world, but my career in it came to a screeching halt. You see, our clients by that time soon caught that having a guy from Hamburg at the table meant having someone who understood our Turkish clients inside and out. So so I could practically read between the lines to figure out if a steel mill could pay more cash or not. And and that was the moment when I was gently, of course, asked to help out on our non-ferrous yards.
Okay.
And this helping out moved to a journey until today. So my knack for understanding Turkish negotiations ended up being my ticket to the non-ferrous world. And so one minute I was decoding whether a steel mill can pay a few extra bucks. And, and the next I was knee deep in the excitement of the LME and the wild world of financial markets. It's like I stumbled into a whole new universe by accident. And and here we can use the word kismet again.
Apparently.
Yeah, again.
It's terrific. And how about the trade association aspect? I mean, I think I first knew of you because of your involvement with BIR and then also the VDM in Germany, but clearly that had to have a start. How did someone talk you into that?
I think let's say it in a general way. I even don't remember how it started. Of course, people ask you to join, but in the commercial life, you know, you know VDM in Germany, of course, or BDSV in Germany, and then it's the same with BIR. So being involved with the BIR, you know, is an enriching experience for me. So I see internationally the BIR as the premier platform, Brian, for networking, you know, within our remarkable recycling industry. So I've always been passionate about showcasing the benefits of our industry. You know, people can see the piles on our yards, but they don't understand what this beautiful business means. So so when the opportunity arose to contribute to this fantastic organization, so I jumped at that chance. So I was asked, and then of course I took the chance. And during, you know, all the years, I mean, I met so many colleagues, and I worked with so many colleagues in various capacities within the BIR, VDM, and it's really enjoyable. Because you know, it makes fun, but it's also enlightening, because you learn a lot, I can tell you. I mean, one particularly memorable experience was participating in the challenge.
Okay, right. For those not familiar, that's the BIR. During the pandemic, I believe this effort started. Murat and Michael Lyon and Mark Cellier would be three co-hosts of a set of podcasts or webcasts that would kind of try to bring together the recycling community as best as it could in a time when we weren't literally allowed to be together on the same stage or in the same meeting room. Is that a pretty accurate description?
Yeah, absolutely. And because I said enjoyable, but it was really nice. I mean, like working with Michael was always an adventure, I can tell you, because preparation was practically non-existent. I mean, you never quite knew what he had up his sleeve, which made it really uniquely dynamic and exciting. So it made fun. It was a great time, I would say. But in general, BIR meetings, I mean, they provide a fantastic opportunity to connect with individuals from all continents, and that only in just a few days. So it's, you exchange ideas, discuss new initiatives with like-minded professionals around the globe. So I would say, you know, I'm very happy that I was asked, and overall, my involvement with the BIR, you know, it has broadened my perspective on the industry and reinforced the importance of collaboration and innovation and driving its success. So especially in times like now, when, I mean, like, look outside, so many crises. You wake up every day with a new headline, and especially in these days, we need to come to talk and to find solutions together, you know. And it's a very, very important, let's say, Dave, association, I would say.
Right. Okay, terrific. Geopolitical turmoil, notwithstanding, it seems from a vantage point where I sit that the world's hunger for scrap metal has only grown during the 25 to 30 years you've been doing this. Is that also your perspective? And do you think it can grow yet more?
I would agree to disagree now. It didn't grow all the time. It was a wild ride of the recycled metal world from back in the 90s to now, I agree. Mm-hmm. If I rightly remember, you know, how the situation, I mean, it was in the 90s, it was a little bit like trying to navigate through a labyrinth blindfolded. The market wasn't as transparent as it is now. I mean, you didn't have all the platforms and you know, the multimedia, you know, you call them, you know, internet, WhatsApp, you know, all the other platforms were not existing, of course. Okay, and then I remember, you know, they gave me a land card in my hand and a key of a car and said, go and search suppliers. So that's actually how the business was functioning. And then I very much remember the in the 90s that we hit the steel crisis. You have that also in mind. So I didn't know by the time what that means, actually. And because you said since then it was only a rising demand. But let me explain that, you know, usually as a shredder yard, you were paying for old cars to feed your machines, right?
Okay,
and to win back the resources. Mm-hmm. And during the steel crisis in the 90s, you know, people were paying out cash just to get rid out of their old cars. Uh-huh. So talk about adding insult to injury. You know? So people were scratching their heads, wondering what the future held. And let's just say the demand was nothing to write home about. But then you're right. I mean, the new millennium rolled in, Brian, and and it was supposed to be the Chinese decade. Yeah, that is. So no matter how much recycled material was floating around, there was one nation until 2008 that could buy as much as it was able to feed its unbelievable appetite for resources. And that was China. So I spent nearly a decade of my life in Asia. Let me tell you, no country had the phenomenal quickness in those first 10 years like China did. You know, sometimes between visits to a city, entire new districts would pop up out of nowhere. Every time I remember I was landing in Shanghai, you know, the district Pudong,
absolutely,
was popping up. Yeah, Yeah, and then Pudong had a new building every time I arrived. So or AirPods were going up faster than I could assemble an IKEA shelf. And or look at the entire infrastructure that was getting a facelift quicker than any GPS could follow. I mean, I was fascinated. I don't know if you have seen that, but I remember the highway between Shanghai and Ningbo.
Okay.
And I don't remember exactly when it was. Maybe you know it, 2004, 2005, 2006. I don't know it, actually. I don't. But, I mean, like this huge highway and then this unbelievable long bridge, 30, 40 kilometers long. Mm. I don't know. Yeah. That was unbelievable. And they just built it in, feeling-wise, 1 month. Of course, not in 1 month, but it was simply like ready. Yeah. You know? Yeah, yeah. And, I mean, like in Germany, they're discussing a bridge for 10 years and how to build it. And
we won't mention the Berlin airport. We don't want to, you know.
it was an eye-opener, wasn't it, Brian? Mm-hmm. I mean, like how fast the things were coming. So, and then, then came other Asian players into the mix. Of course, now countries like India, Pakistan, Vietnam, and many other beautiful nations are definitely competing for resources, for our resources, to fuel their economic growth. And and actually, the reason is because our metals are like superheroes, I always say, in the fight against CO2 emissions. Every ton of recycled material saves up 95% energy. And it's actually, and this is something also what we need to say, it's not only saving energy, but it's also processed under the highest standards. So no matter where you use them in the world, because we are now again discussing these export bans and whatever. Right. So no matter where you use them in the world, they're cutting energy and CO2 emissions. So, and I would say, again, coming back to your first sentence, you know, why is this wave of demand still rising since 30 years or minimum since the last 25 years? I think the industry is waking up to this fact and and trying to get more out of our top materials into the mix. So, and as I said, all collected, produced, and to the highest environmental and labor standards. So if we look to the raw materials which are coming from the minings, you know, I don't want to compare it, but I think we have the higher environmental and we have the higher labor standards. Yeah. And we can be proud of that. I mean, like, you know, we sometimes, I don't know, I see big mining companies, how good they are marketing themselves. I think if I look to the Europeans or to my US colleagues, you know, how good we are doing, I think we can be louder. So, and we can be much more proud of what we do and how we do, actually, to get the resources. So be ready outside, because this is our decade.
Very
the
good.
Decade of clean resources. Yeah.
Very good. But that does perhaps, Murat, come with a counter, which is that as more people recognize the value of scrap metal, this notion of scrap nationalism is arising in it. And folks who don't want it to travel as far or not leave its home country. What do you think the European Union is getting right about that? Or what might they be getting wrong in terms of trying to regulate how scrap flows in and out of countries?
Yeah, it's a very good question to get a little time to think. But I'm not here to say what is right or wrong, Brian, but I can say how I see it very personally. Yeah, not from a company perspective. I'm not talking for now BIR or VDM or whatever, but just Murat Bayram, as I see it. And you're right. This protectionism is rising, unfortunately. And it's very easy to say, you know, we should close the borders or whatever. And the role of the EU, we should not underestimate its role as well. It's a little bit like when you say, at the moment, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. Don't get me wrong. I mean, like, really, nobody wants plastic clogging up our oceans or getting incinerated or whatever. But what does the EU do at the moment? I mean, they roll out now this new regulation that lumps all waste streams together. I mean, it's a little bit like We have this old saying, you know, give 10 different animals the same type of food, and then you wonder why only one species survives.
And that's a good analogy, yeah.
Yeah, so we are shooting ourselves in the foot, actually. And and now, if you look to it, I mean, we look to more bureaucracy thanks to this regulation, even though we are supposed to be cutting red tape. So it's like... You know, it's like waving the flag for less bureaucracy and then creating a whole new monster that maybe even the authorities won't be able to handle, because they are also understaffed and under-resourced. I mean, if you apply today, I don't know how it is in Asia, to be honest, but if you apply today in Europe or in Germany for a license of a recycling yard, this cannot take you up so many years, 2 years, 3 years, you know. And you know what is even more frustrating, Brian? We can already expect that this new regulation will probably be interpreted differently across the 27 different EU countries. It's usually not even done with a bad intention. But when you hand someone a legal text to study, that's 100 pages long. Yeah,
right.
Some people, including me, yeah. Definitely including me, throw in the towel by page 10. So suddenly something as simple as recycling becomes so overloaded that, even a rocket scientist couldn't keep up. So it's like trying to navigate through your house and the exit keeps moving every time you take a step forward. Yeah? And let's not forget one very, very important point also. The EU is both, because coming back again, because you said it rightly with this nationalism or protectionism, but we are an importer and exporter, you know? Sometimes we import more metals in certain qualities than we export. So if we start shutting down international trade, ladies and gentlemen, don't be surprised if other countries follow. And kick us out of the global marketplace.
Right.
Yeah. And again, what I said before, and this is also a message what we need to shout out every time where we are able to, you know, our recycled metals aren't waste, right? Mm-hmm. So, but because we keep getting labeled as such, the authorities are all up in arms about it. So it's crazy. Right. When you see concentrates from mines with metal content sometimes below 20%.
Okay.
And then you look at our metals, yeah? Like we take now, let's say, copper Milbury. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's up to 100% metal content. And then somehow the concentrate is considered as a product while our metals are labeled as waste. You know what we need, Brian? We need someone to pull the emergency brake on this train, you know?
That seems to be the case.
Someone needs to correct this.
Look how it's all gone the last few years. Yeah. But, I mean, regulators often base their policies on how they perceive the recycling industry to be. And I know both ISRI in Washington and BIR globally, you know, are trying to change that perception. How do you think those efforts are going? Is the wider public, our government officials, are they starting to think of recycling differently than they may have 10, 20 years ago, or is there still just a lot to be done?
Short answer, there needs to be a lot to be done.
Okay.
Let me explain. We need to be fair with the politicians. Imagine you, Brian, would be a EU parliamentarian. There are sitting 750 are sitting in Brussels, 750. And they are surrounded by 25,000 lobbyists in Brussels. Uh-huh. So you're outnumbering you, Brian, by more than 32, 33 even, right? So then, and then consider this. Those 25,000 lobbyists collectively have a 1.5 billion budget every year. You can read all this data on the official EU website for lobbying.
Okay.
And then amidst this whirlwind, you are expected to become an expert on every economic sector, recycling.
Including recycling, along with making blenders and making automobiles and clothing.
That's not possible. not possible. Yeah, so it's a little bit like, let's go into another picture. But it's like trying to solve a Rubik's cube, like in our childhood, yeah, while riding a unicycle through a swarm of bees. And the bees in this picture are the lobbyists. Yeah? Theoretically feasible, but practically very hard to succeed. So what is the result? And as I said, we need to be fair, of course, in this perspective, and we need to be more loud. And I think BIR and ESRI and BDM in Germany, BDSB, they are doing it right. They are getting now more louder. And but the result is also because of this, what I just told you before, with all the lobbyists and the whirlwinds, we see it manifested in regulations like the new waste shipment regulation. It's going, through linguistically, through an odyssey, through 27 countries, and then lost in translation, interpretation. You know, we have a waste shipment regulation today, for example, where you have green listed metals, for example, but in some countries they are red listed. So, but we are one European Union. Yeah, it's already very bureaucratic. Let's say that.
Certainly.
And I think we need to unify much more. I mean, under the banners like BIR, URIC, we forgot URIC to mention, of course.
Well.
And let me say it to all of my colleagues in this industry: each of us has a part to play. I mean, even those who might not relish political discourse can make a difference. In your community. I mean, showcase how you are not just in the business of recycled materials, but show how we are rescuing resources every single day. And then, and last but not least, recycled metals on our yards, they are not waste. So we need to protest and correct a wrong decision taken over 20 years ago.
Yes, that seems very sound advice. And I certainly think as a media group, we try to keep that in mind at all times too. Don't conflate the word waste with the word recycled metal, any kind of scrap that has a value.
And it is the wording. It is, again, marketing. It is, just to showcase, this is not waste, And, and it's also very important to talk about recycled aluminium, recycled copper, recycled brass, recycled zinc, recycled lead. These are real resources, green resources.
Right. We've got a few minutes left, and let's perhaps try to dwell on something that will lead us off on a positive note. It's a question I'd like to ask just about all my guests. But if you're having a conversation with someone who was kind of where you were almost 30 years ago, you just had been kindly invited to a scrapyard or recycling yard, it's your first time there. And so this young person now, who is where you used to be, says, is this a good industry? Should I be optimistic about this industry? Do I have a future here? How do you advise that young person?
I still feel young, Brian. You say it now.
I didn't mean to imply that you're finished, Murat, but you're old enough to
I think my mind is still the same. My mind is still the same, like when I was the first time stepping on that yard. It's only the body who's not able to follow my mind sometimes. You're right. It's a very positive question, and I think it's also an easy question, Brian. So, let's say what excites me about the future of recycling industry is its inherent adaptability and resilience. So this industry isn't just about reusing materials. It's about reimagining possibilities and reshaping the future. So we are confronted with global challenges. We all know that. I mean, like climate change and resource scarcity. So the demand for sustainable solutions has never been greater. And again, recycling stands at the forefront of this movement. You can't do anything wrong joining us to all these young guys there. So what makes me particularly optimistic is the innovative spirit that comes with our industry. So from advanced sorting technologies. We see, for example, the new machines coming up, the X-ray slips to sort aluminium alloys. Mm-hmm. I mean, to creative upcycling initiatives. I mean, you are reporting it by yourself.
there is a constant drive to push boundaries and explore new avenues. So this dynamic environment offers a wealth of opportunities for the young individuals, you know, whom you said to attract our industry, actually. Moreover, the recycling industry isn't just about the environmental lessons. I mean, sometimes the people say, yeah, it's an environmental lessons. No, it's also a hub of economic activity and job creation. Certainly. I mean, like, we transition towards to a circular economy. There will be increasing demand for skilled peoples and professionals across various disciplines. I mean, engineering, logistics, marketing, and also if we look to the waste shipment regulation policy advocacies.
Exactly. And attorneys, I'm afraid.
Yeah. So I don't know. I mean, for a young person, entering the recycling industry presents a golden opportunity, I would say. I mean, to be a part of something bigger than themselves. So it's a chance to be at the best place of innovation, driving positive change while forging a rewarding career path. So with, you know, and this is also something very, very important. You need dedication, you need passion, you need discipline and the willingness to learn. And the possibilities are truly unlimited in this dynamic and future forward sector. So ladies and gentlemen who are just now coming out of the school, yeah, you are ready to change the world. Dive into metal recycling where every piece counts. Yeah.
Those are very encouraging words, Murat. And I think, you know, it's good for me to hear. And hopefully it's good for most of our listeners to hear that kind of encouragement. I suspect a lot of them feel the same way, but it's always good to have the reinforcement. Our guest today has been Murat Bayram of EMR, based in Hamburg, Germany. I thank you very much for your time. I hope you've had a good time, Murat.
Thank you very much for your time, Brian. And see you soon in one of these great conventions.
Murat, thank you very much. And yes, for those listening, I hope Murat and I will see each other in October in Singapore at the BIR. It has a meeting in Copenhagen first, I know. But for those who can make it over here to Singapore, you'll probably see us both, and maybe you'll have a chance to revisit this conversation. Murat, thank you very much.
Thank you as well, and stay safe and see you soon.
Appreciate it. Bye for now.